Welcome to the January 15th edition of Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley. Since it's a national holiday, Martin Luther King Jr. Day, we recorded today's show instead of coming to you live. It's still a great show, if I do say so myself, and I hope you keep the dial tuned right here for the next hour. We'll start the hour with a new guest. She's a relative newcomer on the local transportation scene. She's helping to fill a big gap left by the absence of All Resort Express. Melanie Marier, owner of Canyons Transportation, will be with us to address how the local transportation scene has changed, with longtime local business All Resort Express leaving, and even with new disruptive economies like Uber and Lyft picking up more passengers. Marier tells us why she decided to double down on her new business. Then we are less than a month away from the kickoff of the Winter Olympics. We thought that would be a good time to replay an interview we did in October of last year with a sports economist about what effect the Olympics have on local venues. Does the high cost of putting on the games pay off in the long run? Of course, if you lived in Park City in 2002, you probably have an opinion about that. So stay tuned to hear what that economist has to say. And finally, in the spirit of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, where we honor courageous moral leadership, we thought it was appropriate to revisit just a small part of our conversation, also last October, with author Nancy Keene. She's a historian at the Harvard Business School and author of Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. She tells us who she thinks today's great leaders are. I hope you stay tuned. Mountain Money will be right back. I'm Renee Bodley, General Manager of KPCW and co-host of Mountain Money. Our first guest this morning is Melanie Marier, owner of Canyons Transportation. My co-host, Doug Wells, and I sat down with her last week to talk about longtime local transportation company, All Resort Express, leaving the Park City market, and how she had to quickly adjust her business model to pick up new customers, plus other opportunities and challenges her shuttle company faces, and what she has in store for Sundance. Here is that interview, recorded on January 8th. We are here with Melanie Marier, owner of Canyon Transportation. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
Thanks for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to do a special thank you to Canyon Transportation because you guys were the ones who helped us fulfill our pledge drive premiums in August when All Resort Express went under. You guys stepped up and provided the shared shuttle rides for our listeners and the people who gave KPCW money. I want to say a big thank you for that.
That was the least we could do. I mean, it took us all by surprise, and we saw how difficult it was for passengers who had already committed money, actually, to rides, including your pledgers. So, yeah, it was an easy thing for us to do, and we're glad we did it.
Well, it was much more than the least you can do. We were extremely appreciative. I'm on the board of trustees of the station, and I was very proud of the work that the station did, and I was proud of what your company did to step up and help people out. You know, I think it was particularly striking because the bankruptcy was announced shortly after the pledge drive, so people had just pledged. And I know that that's an important piece. People have trips, you know, maybe they're going to be away for the holidays in the fall, and that's what they're planning on to getting to the airport. So you just finished a very busy season for Canyon Transportation. You're about to start another busy season. I would guess it's the week between Christmas and the first of the year, and then Sundance is your busiest time. How was the holidays with less snow than normal here in Park City?
It's very difficult for us to say this year because our business, we were active in Park City before All Resorts bankruptcy. But of course, the void that was left made it so that all the local companies now are busier. So being busier, I'm just not sure how much more busy we would have been if it had been a good season. But we are busier. And I think I can talk, you know, for all the transportation companies in Park City right now.
So let's go back to August, September of 2017 when All Resort went away. How did that affect you guys? How quickly, how suddenly, and how did you react to it?
Well, my first reaction was an urgent meeting with my management staff to actually decide what the strategy was going to be. The airport was the most affected because people were showing up with reservations, but there was just no one at the desk. So we had to ramp up, send more vehicles right away, and have our airport staff ready to take on more passengers and bring them to destination. Of course, for those passengers, unfortunately, we couldn't honor what they had paid. There was no way for us. So for them, they had to pay twice. But initially, my reaction was, let's stretch this team thin because this is who we are and this is how we've been successful so far. So that's all the business we're going to take. But then I'm an entrepreneur, so 48 hours later, the weekend later, I went back to my staff on the Monday and just said, okay, we're doing this. So went and ordered 20 more vehicles. Looked for space in Park City, so we now have an office in Jeremy, and then we decided to go full on. So
20 vehicles, that's a huge investment on your part. What was the base? How many vehicles did you have before?
We usually run 40 in the winter, so we're up, by 50%.
Wow, so you had to hire new drivers too, I'm guessing.
And this also was very fortunate that a lot of those drivers were also looking for work.
Right.
Yeah. So the talent and the experience has been able to stay in the industry. And we were probably the first ones equipped to being able to absorb that. So I think we did well there, too.
So, Melanie, you're an entrepreneur. One of the things I share with entrepreneurs is, there's some scary things out there. You can't predict the scary things that are going to happen. You also can't predict the things that are going to happen in your fortune that are going to be tailwinds for you. Clearly, All Resorts going out of business was a tailwind for the other transportation companies. You've also faced a huge headwind, though, in the last several years with the rise of Uber and Lyft. How has that impacted your business?
Well, until now, the majority of our business was on the Wasatch Front. And I've seen the statistics that come out every other year, in conjunction with Ski Utah. And there's some transportation statistics that show that it doesn't affect the Wasatch Front as much. There is a culture of actually riding in a shared transportation or a private transportation to the resorts out there. But then I saw the numbers here. So for sure, there has been, I think it was 24% of now the visitors that say that they have taken Uber or Lyft. I'm not sure if it's to come here or it's while they are here. So, yes, and people are less patient, too, at the airport. They just landed and they just expect transportation right away, no matter the weather and the road conditions. So we've seen that shift in the culture in the last 3 to 4 years. But I believe that this town and our ski industry also needs the shared ride solution. It does fit a need, and it's important for us to have a certain volume to be able to offer this. For any company who offers shared rides, needs a base volume to operate.
Tell our listeners how shared rides work.
So you make your reservation for one up to, how many in your party. At some point it makes more sense to then do a private vehicle. But, one, two, or three people would just decide to make a group or individual reservations, and they will be grouped with other people who arrive at the same time at the airport or on the departure. It's the same thing. We would have two or three stops to pick up different pickup points, hotels, and then we would head to the airport. So you have to allow a little bit more time than a straight ride to the airport.
Now, Park City is not your main market. It's kind of a market that is getting quite a bit more attention in the last 6 months from your company. But one of the things that's been in the headlines here lately is this ride that the city is looking to sign a contract with somebody to have kind of this Uber-like experience, but subsidized by the city. What are your thoughts on what the city's trying to achieve there?
Are you talking about the more remote areas that would be served?
Microtransit, yeah.
The microtransit. Yeah. I love the idea. I mean, that fits really well with what we do, because if we could have set pickup points and times for those residents where, they don't get picked up, because this is one of the headaches of actually operating in Park City is on the shared ride, is that we can't go out of our way for 20 minutes and back, because then the other passengers get irritated because now it's too long of a ride.
Melanie, that's really interesting. I never thought about that from the shared service point of view. So if the city had a microtransit option where someone in Park Meadows, and again, I think it just takes you to the nearest bus stop, and it solves that 1 mile,
more,
2 mile.
I'm not sure they have the final vision for it. I think it's evolved several times.
Definitely, and it's not in place. It's been through several iterations. But if they did come up with something like that, then your shared shuttle would say, okay, we will pick you up at that bus stop.
Absolutely.
That's interesting. So you've been operating along the Wasatch Front for how many years?
The founder, Norm Sonwhite, started 30 years ago. So, and it's an interesting story where he was just a bellman at the Cliff Lodge, and sometimes the taxis couldn't make it up the hill, and he had to take the Cliff Lodge Suburban to get the guests to the airport, and was making great tips. And he's like, huh, maybe that's something I need to get into.
And you purchased the business from him when?
In August 2014.
Oh, so you've been doing it for only a few years now.
Yeah, absolutely. And for us, for my family and I, it was a decision we had made to come and move our lives to Utah. And being aliens, one way for us to have a proper visa was to be investors. And so we looked at different kinds of businesses that we could own and operate, and this one was the one that appealed to us.
Let's talk about being aliens. You're not from Mars. you're actually from Quebec. Your husband's from France. Where were you guys before here? What was your journey? What were you guys doing before here?
My husband is still in the mining industry, still works in and out of Africa. I spent 15 years of my career in Africa and Asia, in mining as well. And I happened to come on an assignment in 2011 for my business, who was in South Jordan and stayed a couple of years. And then when we left again back to Africa, and we missed Utah that much, so we were ready to settle. Something was telling us that it was time.
Well, let's stay on this for a minute, because I was reminded of something that I had forgotten just last week. I met with somebody who had spent 6 years in France, and she had recently come back, and I asked her, you know, what was that transition like? And actually, she said it was harder coming back from France to the U.S. than it was the other way. Just that the pace of life is so different here. What was business like in Africa, and how's it different here?
Well, for me, I can't, it's the opposite, because this was a lifestyle choice. This was me being able to recreate or create what I wanted my life to be, just, you know, this midlife reorienting. And, you know, I've been more or less successful. You know, sometimes I still work too much, but I'm able to, you know, at that point of being a business owner, I can then take measures to reorganize, you know, the business and my staff that I trust a lot, and then take some time to remember why I'm here.
So you probably took that into consideration last fall when you thought about it over that weekend and came back on Monday and told your staff, we're going to increase our fleet by 50%. So that meant you were going to be working pretty hard for a while until you got that into a good groove. So that had to have involved a little bit of personal sacrifice, I'm guessing.
Yes, absolutely. That's always what I have in mind. And I have to remind myself, you know, this, there's no personal achievement in this for me of saying, you know, oh yes, we're growing by so much. I want us to have a sustainable size and give a sustainable service. And that's my goal. Now, things have fallen on my lap every year since I've owned the company. I also own Express Shuttle that does mainly shared rides in the valley between Provo and North Ogden. And that was something that happened a year earlier. So the stars are aligned right now. I mean, I'm touching wood, but this is, just really good fate.
The stars are aligned, but yet your business is a very complex business. I mean, a lot of folks don't understand all of the logistics that take place. You've got You've got vehicles that need maintenance. You've got vehicles that break down. You have employees that get sick occasionally. So it's a very complex business. As somebody that bought into the business looking for lifestyle balance, how have you found that to be?
I was used to this kind of capital-intense business and also labor-intense and seasonal. That had been my life in the mining industry.
But you weren't personally on the hook for the capital intensity. Now you are. How does that change things? Like you just bought 20 new vehicles. I'm imagining each of those vehicles have a personal guarantee by you and your husband.
Yeah, October, November, I sleep a little less. And then when the season starts again, the seasonality is probably the worst. And then that was a nice thing with Express Shuttle now being under the same roof. We do have more stable work over the summer. I'm hoping that, stepping into Park City with all the groups, that the town attracts, that we will be able to also have more business in the summer. But no matter what, you quadruple your business when comes December. The biggest challenge right now is the low employment rate. Mm. And I can't fix this. Not on my own. Like, this is...
And I hope you don't fix it, right? Because low unemployment is great for a lot of people.
Absolutely.
How do you make your company more attractive versus all the others?
Yeah, but we're fighting against all the other snow jobs there.
Yeah. And our listeners, we're taping this interview on Monday the 8th, but our listeners will hear it on Monday the 15th, MLK Day. And coming up in just a few days, this Thursday is going to be the start of Sundance. So what accommodations are you making to get ready for that time of year?
So a decision was made by the previous owner that, based on experience, that Sundance is something that we prepare with the resources that we have. And that's it. That's all we can do. Trying to make the very most of it has proven in the past to not necessarily be the best choice. You're going to run thin no matter what. We've just decided not to try to be everybody's solution, but we will be there. And, our vans will be going up and down full, all day.
Are you telling your drivers expect longer days instead of 8-hour days?
Guys, absolutely.
It's going to be 12-hour days. So you're maximizing your resources, but just not bringing in any additional resources?
Exactly. Yeah. So everyone is very motivated at Sundance, to make the most of it. And, everyone's taking a little break before that happens because, the hours were long during the holidays and they're going to be long again during Sundance.
It's important to know who you are, right? If you're trying to keep market share and, you got 25% market share and that's really important, then you do have to ramp up and that comes with opportunities but also risk. Being consistent with who you are also makes decisions for you on the type of vehicles. And one of the trends that I'm seeing now is the electric vehicles, the city program. They did have a preference for electrical vehicles. Have you looked at that? Do you see that in your future?
I'm on the board of Utah Clean Cities, so that's something that's really close to my heart. We have started converting our vans to propane. That is one of the best alternative fuel for us. Electrical, 100-mile range right now for a van. That's not uphill. That's not in the cold, so a lot less. It's not there right now, but I want to be the first. I want to be the first in Utah for sure. So
that will get you a lot of fans in this community if you're going for a sustainable model. We only have a couple of minutes left, Melanie. Anything about Canyon Transportation that we have not touched on that you want our listeners to know?
Absolutely. On our website, Park City residents will be able to find a way to create their account and save 15% on every ride, as long as we're around. And so we'd like your listeners to take advantage of that. So all the instructions, if they look for airport rates and look at the Park City sections of the airport rates, and they'll find a link there and instructions. I mean, we do want to verify that they are residents. So any proof of residency, it could be a driver's license or just a bill that they'll have to send us by email. And then we'll add their account that they've created to a profile that will give them a 15% discount.
That's a great tip to help locals save money. I'm curious. This is your business. This is your livelihood now. When we go to other towns, when we go to Seattle, when we go to Orlando, when we go to San Diego, what should we know about, what would your advice be? Here's how to find a good shuttle service.
Well, there are, you know, nationwide brands that operate in a lot of cities. You know, there are a lot of groups that have just expanded and can be found. So those groups for sure are reliable, and then they're a bit different if it's East Coast or West Coast. But I would say that if you find the local company that offers exactly the same service, you know, the desk at the airport, the same convenience, that local company really brings the profit back to the town you're visiting. And that's something that I'm always mindful. I mean, I've lived all over the world, and I make sure that I participate in the local economy as much as I can.
So, Melanie, what does Canyon Transportation look like 5 years from now?
That's something that I would have been really wrong answering just 3 years ago.
Oh.
So I don't know if I would have ventured there. Transportation is changing. Even though I believe that we will probably be the last, like mountain towns will be the last ones to see autonomous vehicles, is it 5, 7, 8 years? I think it will happen fast. So we'll see how we will integrate that for sure.
Melanie Marier, Canyon Transportation, thank you so much for being on Mountain Money. Good luck in Sundance.
Thank you very much.
You are listening to Mountain Money here on KPCW. I'm Renee Bodley, your co-host for this show. We air every Monday from 9 to 10. The show has been pre-recorded since today is a national holiday, Martin Luther King Jr. Day. We hope you're having a great day, and thank you for listening. Park City took center stage on the international winter sports scene in 2002, playing host to almost half of the venues for the Winter Olympics. Now the state of Utah is debating whether to vie for another Olympics, possibly in 2026, but most likely in 2030. An exploratory committee will make a recommendation in February to the state legislature. Back in October, when the committee was announced, my guest co-host, Roger Goldman, and I interviewed Victor Matheson. He's a professor of economics and accounting at the College of the Holy Cross. He has studied many Olympic Games and their economic impact on venue cities. Here is that interview. Good morning, Dr. Matheson.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks for being here this morning or joining us over the phone. First question, are the Olympics good for the host city?
So the experience that we've had over about the last 20 or 30 years is that overall, the Olympics do cause some level of economic benefits to any of these host communities. Unfortunately, for most host cities, the amount of money you have to spend to get those benefits vastly outweighs the total benefits you might get from the Olympics. So, for example, let's go back just a few years to Sochi. Sochi certainly benefited from a huge boost in tourism during the Olympics, but for all those people that they brought in, they ended up spending $51 billion to do it. There's no way that even 50 years or 100 years of tourist boost is going to be able to pay for that $51 billion price tag.
Dr. Matheson, I got a chance over the weekend to read some of your writings on the economics of the Olympics, which I found absolutely fascinating. And as I went through it, I did see this pattern of expenditures that exceed the benefits. I like the way you break down the categories of benefits and the categories of expenditures. But what I'd like to ask you is, how much have you focused on what happened here in Salt Lake City in 2002 and the economic impact of that, both on the positive and the negative side?
Yeah, so we've looked at Salt Lake City for a couple things. So let's talk about the benefits to Salt Lake City. So first of all, if you actually look back at the data and see what happened to employment in Utah and in Salt Lake City and, of course, in Park City and the counties that hosted events, what we did see is a very noticeable increase in employment. employment for about a one-year period around the Olympics. And in total, that added to about 7,000 additional jobs above what we would normally have expected in Utah over that time period. So that's a very real benefit. Mind you, that the predictions of the Olympics were for about 35,000 new jobs. But still, we did see a clear bump in employment for a year that was identifiable. We also saw some very clear increases in taxable sales at places around, again, Park City and Salt Lake City. We saw big increases in the amount of economic activity at bars and restaurants and at hotels. Mind you, that was countered by actual reductions in taxable sales at general retail stores, things like the Walmarts and Targets. And actually, the one industry that actually did very, very poorly during the first quarter of 2002 actually might be a surprise, but the one industry that did most poorly in Utah over that time period was actually ski resorts themselves. You know, they don't make money when people come in to watch other people skiing. They make money when people come in to do the skiing themselves. Actually, the data suggests that the 2002 Winter Olympics were actually very good for ski resorts in Colorado.
But the 2002 Games did benefit the ski resorts after the Games were over in subsequent years, didn't it?
Right. So it does look like the advertising that Salt Lake and Utah in general got from the Olympics did result in some long-term gains in skier visits. So, for example, again, comparing Utah to Colorado, Utah had a very poor skier year in 2002 compared to Colorado, as actual skiers avoided the ski watchers. But in 2003, over the next roughly 10 years, growth in skier visits in Utah did exceed those of the resorts next door in Colorado. So it looks like there was some advertising effect that lingered for some amount of time after the Olympics.
Is there any way to quantify that, or have you tried?
Yeah, so people have tried to do that. It's really hard to know because, again, I think starting in 2002, you know, the Utah ski industry was less developed, less mature than the Colorado one. So you might have expected higher growth rate in, you know, at Snowbird and Alta and those places than you would have had in Colorado at the Vales and the Keystones. So it's hard to account for those trends. But all that put together, it does look like we had a little bit higher growth rate in the ski industry in Utah than in Colorado after the Olympics, and so certainly it would be fair to maybe chalk up some of that to the advertising that Utah got during the Games.
One of the things that was talked about widely at the time was an anticipated real estate value increase here in Park City in particular, and everyone said the Olympics are going to create an enormous boom, and I wonder how that fits into the calculation, A, whether it really happened, and B, to what extent it could be attributable to the Olympics.
So I can't comment on the real estate industry there. This is not something I've looked at all. What we have seen in other cities that have hosted the Olympics is often a kind of a boom-bust cycle because you have a huge amount of investment right around the Olympics because, again, hoteliers and restaurateurs are trying to get large, you know, projects in place so that they can accommodate the big crowds at the Olympics. But then once the Olympics go and all the crowds disappear, all of a sudden you've overbuilt for what you've got. I know certainly in Utah, Utah had pretty low hotel occupancy rates following the Olympics, again, because they kind of overbuilt hotels. What we saw in Lillehammer after the Winter Olympics there is several of the top five-star hotels built for the Olympics declared bankruptcy within 6 months after the Games. I know that didn't happen in Utah, but It certainly is something that you can do, is that you overbuild for the Olympics. And so rather than this big increase in valuations following the Olympics, you get a big run-up in prices before the Olympics and then a collapse afterwards.
And you mentioned Salt Lake City and Barcelona might be unique in the successes they saw. Why is that?
Yeah, so one of the nice things about these places is I call them hidden gems. These are places that really are great tourist destinations. Again, I've been skiing. I grew up in Colorado, but I have skied in Utah and obviously wonderful places there. But, you know, not known for their recreational activities as much as other places around the country. And so if you can advertise something that people don't know about, that really gets them the chance to say, ah, this is a place I hadn't thought about going, and now I will. Barcelona, same sort of thing. Before the summer games there in the 90s, they were only about the 10th most popular tourist destination in Europe. Following this huge, basically 3 months of worldwide advertising during the Olympics, they got to show off what's a really wonderful city and again, a hidden gem. And then they're now the fourth most popular tourist destination in Europe. Of course, we'll see what the current political upheaval is going to do to that. But, you know, compare that to a London. London had the Olympics, but London can't claim that the Olympics put London on the map. It was already the most popular tourist destination in the world, and a bunch of advertising doesn't help them because they're already filled to the gills with tourists. Same thing with Atlanta. Atlanta doesn't have that much to offer a tourist from abroad, and so even having the Olympics there doesn't do a whole lot for the tourism trade after the Olympics are gone, because they don't have that much to offer once the big event packs up.
So have any Utah officials reached out to you in the past 2 weeks?
So, I'm generally known as a big critic of the Olympics. That being said, Utah actually probably does make sense, certainly more than just about any other place in the world. The IOC has had a huge trouble over the last 5 years getting cities that are willing to host their event. During the last Winter Olympics, 5 of the 7 original bidding cities all backed out, mainly because of public outcry about the potential expenses. The last 2 cities left were Beijing and Almaty in Kazakhstan, and of course these are places where the public's voice doesn't matter too much, not exactly beacons of democracy in either of those places. And so I think the IOC is desperately looking for cities willing to step up and host, which means a place like Salt Lake City is likely to get a sweetheart deal from the IOC. On top of that, lots of the infrastructure is already in place. I was at a conference maybe 3 or 4 years ago with Didi Corandini, the former mayor of Salt Lake, and she thought at that time that Salt Lake might be able to put on the Olympics for about $2 billion, roughly the same price that it cost them in 2002. And we can argue about whether $2 billion is worthwhile spending, but at least that's in the ballpark, as opposed to these, you know, $51 billion Olympics in Sochi or $45 billion Olympics in Beijing.
Let's say the governor of Utah, mayor of Salt Lake, and mayor of Park City give you a call tomorrow. You're on a conference call, and they say, Dr. Matheson, what do you advise? Should we go for the Olympics again?
I would say, you know, put a little money into putting a bid together and seeing what it might cost you to put this on, but be willing to walk away from it if the IOC doesn't come up with enough money to be able to counteract a lot of those costs. But it's certainly, again, Salt Lake is, again, one of the few plausible places where the Olympics can be done reasonably and without breaking the bank. Same thing in Los Angeles, which, of course, is hosting the 2028 Summer Games. Again, the United States has a pretty good track record of not letting these things get out of control. We haven't seen these massive cost overruns like we saw in Russia, huge costs associated with Olympics in London, or the worst of all, actually, is the upcoming World Cup in Qatar in 4 years, where the total price tag there might be as high as $200 billion.
And I take it that part of the reason you say that relates to the infrastructure that's still in place here from 2002. I know that I went to Barcelona, and I was hearing you talk about Barcelona and saw weeds growing in what were the ruins of the former Olympic sites there. In contrast, I think that most of the Utah sites are actively being used and could probably be refurbished at a relatively reasonable price to host the next games.
Right. And one of the problems with the Olympics, both the Summer and Winter Games, is they have a bunch of fairly obscure sports that there are not large numbers of cities across the country and across the world that have all of these facilities in place. Not many places have world-class bobsledding runs. Not many places have world-class speed skating ovals. And so it's hard to find places that have these things in place, and, of course, Utah does. You know, I might have argued against Utah trying for the 2002 Olympics, but once you've already spent all that money and built up your infrastructure, you might as well use it as much as you can. And so it certainly is plausible that that Utah could come out ahead in a new in a winter bid here coming up.
As an economist, what do you think of our model with the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, which was given $76 million to subsidize the operations of Utah Olympic Park, Utah Olympic Oval? They now have Soldier Hollow under their operations as well. And right 2 weeks ago, when they announced the formation of this exploratory committee, they also released, they being the state legislature, a performance audit of the Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation, which said that it's running $4 million in the red every year, and that the Olympic Legacy Foundation will run out of money probably in, I think it's 17, 18 years. So I looked at that and thought, is Utah going after another Olympic Games to keep these venues viable? What's your opinion of the Legacy Foundation?
Well, so it's very, very difficult to find uses for these huge facilities once the Games are gone, right? And that's not just Winter Olympics, it's also Summer Olympics. You know, no city needs a 20,000-seat swimming facility. And so you often have the white elephant issue. Obviously, things are still being used in Utah, but of course, they're not being used at the level that they were originally designed for, which is, you know, a world-class Olympic event. So what you end up seeing is these facilities often do need subsidies in order to stay viable through time. And, of course, that's what happens, is that sometimes the legacy is not this great legacy of name recognition and positive infrastructure. Sometimes it's a legacy of infrastructure that actually takes a lot of resources to keep up and running year after year. But, of course, that's all the more reason why if you get an opportunity to use your expensive infrastructure, you should get out and use it. You know, it's like, think about the china at home, you know, you get it all for your wedding and then it just sits there. Well, if you can figure out some events to actually, you know, put out the nice china and the silver, maybe you should do it.
Is the model that Utah followed with you know, retaining this fund and trying to use it to sort of subsidize the operating losses, is that a typical model?
So I would say it's probably not typical in to the extent that here we are 15 years later and most of the facilities are in reasonably good shape. Compare that to even Brazil just a couple years ago. Already some of those facilities have fallen into complete disrepair. Look at Greece. They had an Olympics roughly the same time as Salt Lake City. And huge numbers of their facilities are completely empty, no water in the pools, grown over fields, dilapidated buildings. And so the fact that Salt Lake City and Utah thought well enough ahead that it's pretty easy for these expensive investments to crumble into nothing, again, is to their credit.
So could you argue that there's no harm in Utah going for this rich source of federal tax dollars that would come our way, that did come our way with the 2002 Olympics? I mean, it's part of the reason why we have light rail, that maybe we could cash in again and get some athlete housing up here paid for by federal dollars that could turn into affordable housing for Park City's workforce, which is a big issue in our ski town. Maybe improve our public transit up here, get us some bus rapid express lanes. Is there an argument against why we shouldn't go for those federal tax dollars?
Well, so obviously there's always an argument to be made for getting improvements to your own hometown if someone else pays for it. Now, mind you, I, as a taxpayer here in Massachusetts, don't necessarily want to pay for your light rail. That being said, there is that argument. Some people argue that the Olympics are actually a good thing because it causes local governments actually to spend the money that everyone knows they need to spend, and it kind of gives them that the both, you know, clear deadlines and gives them that push that they need to do these things that they should be doing otherwise. So you do hear that argument a bunch, but of course, yeah, if you can get Washington or Lausanne, Switzerland to pay for a bunch of your costs, well, absolutely go for that. Certainly the big thing that you will see the federal government likely pay for is the massive security presence that's going to be needed for an Olympics. Beyond that, I think you are kind of grasping at straws a little bit, assuming that the federal government's going to sweep in and do a bunch of your infrastructure improvements, though.
But that sort of takes me to a related point, which is you mentioned a while ago the notion that it would depend on what the IOC, what kind of a financial arrangement the IOC would reach with the Olympic Organizing Committee. Can you spend just a minute or two on explaining how the economics works in terms of the relationship between the venue city, the organizing committee, and the IOC? Who pays who for what?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's a great question. So basically, it works like this: is the host city is responsible for all of the costs of putting on the event. So they need venues, they need security, they need housing, they need media access, they need all of that. And that can be, of course, very expensive. And in Utah, that was roughly $2 billion in 2002 when that all occurred. There are some questions about what should count as costs and what shouldn't. You know, all the widening of the interstate from Salt Lake City up into Park City, should that count as Olympic expenses? Who knows? Let's let the accountants worry about that. So in any case, we got these big set of costs. The host organization is responsible for all of that. Sometimes the host organization is the same as the local government. Sometimes that host organization is a completely private organization. The IOC generally wants at least the local government to say, if the private organizing committee collapses in some ways, that the city will be the backstop and will come in and bail out any problems of the local organizing committee. So that's all the expense side. The revenue side is this. There are all of those sponsorships, you know, Coca-Cola, official sponsor of the Winter Olympics. There are all the tickets you can sell. I actually don't have a good grip on how many tickets get sold on the Winter Olympic side, but on the Summer Olympic side, you sell about 10 million tickets for a total cost of about $1 billion in ticket sales. And then, of course, the big one is all of those media rights, right? So you sell the media rights to all of these different folks. Now, the IOC collects all of the media rights. So all of that big NBC contract, the contract with BBC or whoever they broadcast for in the UK and in China and Australia and all over the world, all of that is money collected by the IOC. Typically, the IOC lets the local organizing committee keep all the ticket money, and then the local organizers collect some of the sponsorship money, and then the IOC collects some of the sponsorship money. All right, so now we got all this money in here. The IOC then decides whether they're going to share any of the money with the local organizing committee. So the organizing committee is on the hook for all the costs. They get most of the ticket money and a little bit of the sponsorship money, and then the IOC is the one who's taking in most of the cash, and they decide whether they're going to share any of that TV cash with the local hosts or whether they're going to keep it all themselves and, you know, buy limousines and gold-plated toilets for all the IOC executive members.
And I take it that that's part of the negotiation, is that, negotiating that split up front.
And you got that exactly right. So that's all about the negotiation. And, of course, if there are lots and lots of bidders, the IOC doesn't have to give away much of that TV money to get a city willing to host the Olympics and cover all those costs themselves. On the other hand, in a world like we have now where they are really struggling to get host cities, they're much more generous in what they're willing to give out. And as a matter of fact, Los Angeles, which just, again, got the 2028 Summer Games, got quite a sweetheart deal and ended up getting something like an extra $500 million or billion extra dollars of media money out of the IOC because the IOC was struggling so much to find anyone to host the Olympics in 2024 and 2028.
What was the breakdown for the 2002 games, those percentages?
So similar. So those aren't at my fingertips, but pretty similar to that, right? So basically $2 billion in costs, all borne by the IOC, the local organizing committee and local governments, roughly a quarter of which was direct subsidy from the state and local governments. The rest was generated, was covered by sponsorships, ticket sales, and their share of TV revenue. So that's roughly how it broke down in 2002.
Dr. Matheson, we've actually gone over our time. It's been so interesting talking to you. Are there any final points you'd like to make to our listeners before we say goodbye?
Yeah, the one thing I would like to say is that we do have some evidence that hosting big events like this does make people happy. This is a fun event. It's very festive. You have self-reported happiness of people in London hosting the game saying, this is a great event for us. But we don't have a whole lot of evidence that it makes us rich.
But happiness is priceless, right?
Happiness is certainly something worth going for. And if the folks in Park City say, you know what, we want to go for this because what a great event to host, I have no problems with that. If the government says, hey, let's do this and spend whatever it takes because anything we spend is going to come back to us in some sort of investment return, that's where I'd say, hold on, let's approach this with a little more caution.
It seems particularly apt that MasterCard was a major sponsor of the 2002 Games, as I recall, given the priceless issue. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Matheson. And can we call you back as things develop? Because I think this is going to be an ongoing issue for us.
Oh, I'm happy to talk about the Olympics anytime. I think it's just a great topic, and it's it's nice to actually talk about an event like a Salt Lake City bid that I might actually be moderately optimistic about because, you know, I don't like being the dismal scientist all the time.
Thank you, Dr. Victor Matheson, Professor of Economics and Accounting with College of the Holy Cross. We'll be talking to you again in the future. This is Mountain Money, a public affairs show on KPCW about business in the Park City area. I'm Renee Bodley Miller. My co-host Doug Wells and I also occasionally interview authors of books about finance, money, and leadership. And in October, we were fortunate to catch up with Nancy Keene. She's a Harvard business historian and author of Forged in Crisis: The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Since we honor Dr. King today for his courageous leadership, we thought it was appropriate to hearken back to our interview last fall when we asked Kane who she thought today's great leaders are. Here is her answer.
I think some people that don't get a lot of attention that are courageous are, just to take, you know, the political minefield and what often seems right now at the national level, very devoid of, on both sides of the parties, across the partisan spectrum, devoid of courageous leadership. So let me mention a couple of people. John Lewis, a longtime congressman from Atlanta, from Georgia, who was one of the civil rights leaders working with King and other members of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. Seth Moulton, a very interesting, still being made leader, still a leader being forged, veteran of the Iraq and Afghani conflicts, a young congressman from Eastern Massachusetts, trying to build bridges across the great divides in Congress. Let me mention a couple of people outside the political spectrum who I would urge your listeners to maybe take a look at, sniff around. Melinda Gates at the Gates Foundation, fascinating, extraordinarily intelligent woman, committed to wiping out a number of critical diseases in sub-Saharan Africa and to really, really empowering women in that part of the world. Someone named Paul Pullman, who runs Unilever, who is betting the company, one of the world's largest corporations, on environmental sustainability and willing to take the short-term hits to his stock price to do that. Howard Schultz, who just stepped down as the CEO of Starbucks, who has taken that company in all kinds of fascinating, nonpartisan, social and political directions toward what I think most of us would recognize as the collective good, even though he's taken, again, a lot of heat from business experts and particularly from analysts on Wall Street. So those are just a few of the people that I would mention. And the point is that effective, courageous leaders come in many shapes and sizes, and we recognize them when we smell them or see them.
That does it for this special edition of Mountain Money. I'm Renee Bodley-Miller. Thank you for listening. We couldn't do programming like this without the generous support of our sponsors, Mountain West Bank, Vacasa, Park City Chamber Bureau, Jones, Waldo, Holbrook, and McDonough, Columbus Pacific Properties with Viridian and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, Park City Mountain, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. The Sundance Reel will take our spot next Monday. We will return on Monday, January 29th. Have a great day.